Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You know, it's easy when you're younger, and TikTok does skew younger. It's easy when you're younger to go, oh, I will just be an actor. Whereas, you know, the reality of it is, if you want to be an actor, get ready to starve. And if you want to be an actor, it's not just talent. You also have to have an enormous pool of luck. And then once the luck comes, you have to be ready to graft.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to actor and comedian Ethan Lawrence. Perfect. Hello, I'm Steve Whiteley and welcome to Balancing Acts, a series of conversations with an array of creatives. We talk about their journey, the struggles they faced whilst progressing their career, strategies they use to unlock their creativity, how they balance their career with their personal lives, what impact this has had on their mental health, and lots more. As an actor, Ethan is known for starring in Bad Education, both a TV series and feature film, Modern Horror Stories on Comedy Central, and of course, Afterlife, where he was initially meant to be in only one episode, but Ricky Gervais liked his performance so much, he then played a reoccurring role. This was a great conversation. We talk about Ethan's journey as an actor, what it was like working with Ricky Gervais. Obviously, that was a question that I had to ask. What he likes about talking to his fans directly on TikTok and loads more. We went down the rabbit hole on this one. We start talking about social media, brands, cynical exploitation of certain movements, and lots of other fascinating areas. So, this was a really good one. Very much enjoyed talking to Ethan. We first met on the comedy circuit about 5 years ago. And always found him a very funny guy. So it was great to touch base and have a good natter. So without further ado, over to Ethan. Perfect. So we were just saying before we hit record that the last time we saw each other, we think was in about 2017 or 18 at a gig.
Yes. I'm reasonably certain. Yeah.
Yeah. That you were topless at as part of your shtick.
Almost certainly. Yeah. Especially in that period in my career, I was taking my shirt off a lot.
Yeah. It was hot. Yeah. The venues were hot then. Very hot venues.
It was. I mean, that was partly it.
Yeah.
It's good to dress it up like that at this point now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just warm.
It had nothing to do with your character having a breakdown of sorts on stage.
Absolutely not. No. If you look back on it now, you can see the through line was just a very, very high core temperature.
Yeah, totally.
I run hot. What can I say?
What was it that led you to stop doing stand-up then? Because you were doing, you know, you were gigging hard. Was it because the acting stuff just took over?
It was a combination of two things. I was slowly falling out of love with it.
What aspects were about stand-up were you falling out of love with?
I found that I wasn't really getting anywhere with it. And there was a sense sort of at the back of my mind that like I was, I mean, because I live in Essex and I was traveling into London for every gig.
It's expensive.
So near enough every gig I was doing, I was like firmly in the red.
Right.
I'm losing money on something that I'm not getting much dividends for. So that was happening at the back of my head. But then also in reality, the acting was going very, very poorly. To the point where mid-2018, I took up pizza delivery as what was supposed to be like a stopgap for maybe a couple of months.
Right.
And ended up being a full year.
Okay.
And because I was doing that, I then no longer had evenings because I was busy working. So the comedy went completely. And even after I stopped in 2019, there was a thought in the back of my head, like, well, maybe I can pick it back up. This was around the time that I'd finished shooting Afterlife Series 2, which is what got me out of the pizza delivery. Okay. But that was in late 2019. And then obviously in March 2020, we all know what happened there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's crazy, isn't it? Like, perception is such a funny thing because, you know, you look at someone like yourself, you've done Bad Education, obviously, and numerous other roles. And as you said, Afterlife. And I know I've seen on your TikTok, you do these Q&As, which we'll talk about. And you're very open and honest and transparent with your followers. But you'd think, oh yeah, he's off and away, you know. But it's such a roller coaster, isn't it? You can like be cast in something and be out there, like, yeah, this is amazing, and then that job finishes, and then the phone doesn't ring for the next 6 months or however long.
For sure, and like, you know, it's the same in any sort of creative industry. I think, like, you know, there are periods of great work and then long fallow periods.
Yeah,
but then I mean, it's not just creative work, like, you know. Most folk who work in the creative industry are essentially self-employed contractors.
Yeah.
And that's the same across all kinds of self-employment. Like, you know, if you're a plumber, say, like, you know, you're more likely, I would guess, to have jobs at high in the summer and high in the winter when pipes are playing up. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, spring and autumn, where it's more temperate, you might be okay. It's the same across any kind of self-employed industry. I think One thing that I do, I mean, you mentioned sort of like, you know, being open and transparent about the job. I think there's a level to which the working in the creative industry is kind of has a sort of mystification process around it.
Yeah.
Which is, it certainly was largely before social media. Like, you know, it felt like actors and like musicians and comedy performers were sort of like operating behind like a veil of untouchable godhood. Whereas in reality, as we know, and as I'm trying to sort of teach people, like, you know, it's the same as any other kind of job. There are good spots, there are bad spots. And like, you know, you have to be at a crazy high level to make it like a consistent thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we can't all be Tom Cruise, unfortunately. Although I am the same height as him. So
okay,
that means something, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can see you sort of moving into the lookalike industry.
For sure, yeah.
Tom Cruise.
I've been the Mission Impossibles, I reckon.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, just sellotape me to the bottom of a plane. That'll be fine.
Have you got to a point with it where, because I know you've had a few of these cycles now, where I know it happened after Bad Education, where you had a period where you weren't getting any work, and then you've had that since, because I know you've been, as I said, you've been open about it on Instagram. Have you got to a point now where you've got strategies that you've implemented to protect your mental health when that sort of cycle does happen or rear its ugly head?
I mean, it's interesting you bring that up because even at the top point of the cycle,
yeah,
you do have to be very consciously aware that it can go at a moment's notice. Like, right. One of the most difficult things I think about working, certainly at my level in the acting industry, is that, like, 9 times out of 10, when you go up for an audition, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I joke sometimes that I've had more job interviews than some people have had hot dinners.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, if you count it as a job interview, and each time you get blown back a failed job interview, like, you have to have already developed that thick skin.
Yeah.
To go, right, okay, so that didn't work out, so on to the next. So I guess the mental health armor that you have in that regard is that you just have to keep marching. Like, you know, it's a forced march into the darkness, but it requires also a certain level of self-belief where you think to yourself, right, didn't get that one, but I've got this behind me. I've got this to do now. And in the future, that can bring other things.
Yeah.
Like, you have to sort of compartmentalize part, present and future to sort of, so you know, you can use nostalgia to help yourself feel better. You can look at the list of auditions that you have to make you feel better. And you can also think to yourself, right, well, I've got this job. Like, continuity is one of the best things you can have in this industry. Like, certainly for Bad Education and Afterlife, like, knowing that I'll be coming back for another series, like, you know, yeah. I know that in March there will be this paycheck.
Yeah,
is a beautiful thing. something that the pandemic royally messed up.
Yeah.
But then even then, I secured a job like right in the middle of March for some work on Horrible Histories.
Yeah.
Which we just finished that now.
Right.
So it was still in the pipeline. It was still going. So it's all about planting seeds, I think.
And it's quite a precarious balance, isn't it? Because you're going into these auditions knowing, as you said, that there's a very slim chance that you're going to get the job. You're going to book the job. But you also have to go in with a certain amount of optimism. And because, you know, there's a certain mindset. You're like, almost like this thing of visualization. You know, I'm visualizing that I'm going to get this job. So it must be like a weird balance to try and figure that out in your mind to go in there with the sort of to protect yourself from the potential disappointment, but also to not go in there too pessimistic almost.
I mean, it's something that I've had to learn to do over the course of my career, which is just knowing your worth.
Right.
Like, you know, it took a long while for me to get there mentally.
Yeah.
But once I got to a stage where I'm like, no, I am good at this. Like, you know, this, I am a very, very good professional actor.
Yeah.
And also once you start to sort of see through the gauze of it, like, you know, so it, more often than not, it doesn't come down to individual talent so much in this industry. Like, obviously everyone who's going up for these parts is good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's not in question. It's more of a case of shape and size and sound and chemistry. And like, these are things that you can't teach.
Yeah. Completely like, you know, out of your control.
Yeah. And you have to accept that to a certain degree. And honestly, when you do accept that, it feels like a burden has been lifted to a certain degree.
For sure. Yeah. There's something about just letting go.
Yeah. Cause you think to yourself, well, I didn't book that, but that's not because I'm not good.
Yeah.
It's because I was the wrong shape. It was because they had someone booked already that I didn't have good chemistry with.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's more to do with that than talent. And I think if you're sort of early doors in a career in a creative industry, that's something that you have to learn pretty fast if you want to get anywhere really without sort of debilitating yourself mentally.
Yeah. Was that something that was drilled into you or was taught when you were studying theatre studies at university? And also, was there an element of trying to prep you for how this industry can affect your mental health in a detrimental way?
But I didn't actually go to like a drama school. I went to a university to study drama and creative writing, which was largely more theoretical.
Okay, you went to Royal Holloway, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that wasn't a course that was, as you put it, sort of like prepping you for the industry. It was more about creating, like, you know, drama academics, future, you know, doctors and PhDs and things like that.
I see. Okay.
So while there were elements in there that were sort of like, you know, the mechanics of theatre and things like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I guess the word you'd use would be vocational. Yeah. Like, it wasn't sort of like a vocational degree.
Right.
So all this stuff I basically learned on fly the job. by actually doing it and experiencing it.
Yeah. Have you found agents in the past to be particularly helpful and supportive in that realm?
Well, I've been with one agent only since I've been working in the industry, and that only happened because after the second series of Bad Education, I knew a guy who knew a guy who used to work for a guy.
I know a guy, and then I met that guy.
Yeah, you know, and I went on down to the big city, and he said, "Yeah, yeah, something about you, kid." But yeah, I've been with him for 8 years now, and it radically changed my career. Like, you know, because before it was like, It was so tenuous. It was on tenterhooks. Like, you know, I went off to do Bad Education sort of apropos of nothing.
Mm.
And then I was like, oh, well, that was fun, but surely nothing will come of this. And then suddenly it's like series two and it's like, okay, well, we're on a roll here. Yeah. And then Michael, my agent, sort of saw something in me and was like, right, well, we can do something here. And since then, I mean, straight after that, I booked a show on Sky Living called Trying Again. And that was like wicked smart. And it was like, great. So, okay, I've now set myself up in a position where I'm ready to go. Like, I have a burgeoning career here.
Yeah. And do you consider now your agent like a mate, or because it's difficult sometimes to decipher the relationship between talent and an agent, because essentially it's a business relationship. But I guess particularly in your case, where you've been working with the same person for a number of years, you're going to potentially grow closer as a result. How have you found navigating that relationship?
It's been on the whole, but it has just generally just been good. Like, yeah. You know, we've got a good working relationship. Like, you know, we at beginning and sort of midpoint of every year, we have a conversation about, you know, what do you want to do for the next 6 months? But then, so that's all good. Like, you know, it's a conversation rather than a, you do this, you do this, you do this.
Yeah.
And like, in addition to that, like, you know, if there's like a screener for something that I've done or anything like that, like Michael is priority number one for the guest list.
Right.
And like, you know, that will be when we go out and like, you know, watch our thing that we managed to get together and then get rat-assed in the hotel lobby.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. So
what are you getting to the game for?
That's it. The glamour.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's, yeah. So I very much consider Michael a friend, you know, alongside being being business partners in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. And what's it been like when you're on set with the likes of Jack Whitehall and Ricky Gervais? Has there been any element of imposter syndrome or, you know, this feeling of like, wow, you know, these guys are top of their game. I really need to be on point.
I mean, imposter syndrome, I found, never really goes away. And okay. I think that's largely tied into the fact that what we were discussing earlier with how sort of tenuous this can be sometimes, like, you know, yeah. How fragile the whole thing is. Like, you know, and it wasn't so long ago. I mean, it's only 2019 that I stopped doing pizza delivery. Like, you know, it's only 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So that was a humbling experience. But in terms of to get to the meat of your question, like, you know, working with like, you know, people who are far far more advanced in the industry than I am or possibly will ever be.
Yeah.
I think early doors because like we're basically talking about the bookend of my career here. Because yeah. Bad Education was the first thing that I did, and Afterlife Outside of Horrible History is the most recent.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a period of nearly 10 years. So I would hope one would have changed over the course of 10 years.
Yeah.
Certainly early doors with Jack, like, you know, I felt incredibly grateful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, to be working in the industry that I'd always wanted to work in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, that's that. But like, yeah. Moving on to sort of Afterlife, and especially what happened between series one and two. Because in series one, I was essentially a cameo performance. Like, I was in one scene.
Yeah.
Sticking some recorders up my nose. And then a year later, I get the call saying, yeah, you're coming back, but you're coming back in all six episodes. And I think that was
such a great feeling to know that, you smashed incredible. That scene beyond belief, that they've decided to make you, you know, a reoccurring character.
Absolutely incredible. And like, especially coming off the back of a year in the pizza delivery wilderness, it was like, yeah. No yeah. way, I have got this.
Yeah.
And it really sort of reframed and refocused my relationship with my own sort of self-confidence and performance. Because I was thinking to myself, well, look, like, Ricky Gervais is Ricky Gervais. And he's upgraded me from cameo to series regular.
Great, man.
He must have seen something, because like, Afterlife yeah. is his baby. Like, you know, he yeah, writes yeah. and directs and stars. Like, you know, it's not, you know, it's not some sort of like sideways casting director sort of shifting in me in at 90 degrees. This is yeah. the governor saying you.
Yeah.
And you know, there's something to that, because I mean, my God, if you're in Ricky Gervais's good books, then that's a good place to be as an actor, and especially as a comedy performer.
Yeah, that's must be a remarkable feeling. And what was the experience and process like of working with Ricky, you know, who's someone who's I always say this, I always say it with American accent, a multi-hyphenate. I was at this film festival a couple of years ago, and they had a panel with like all the American agents. And they'll say, you know, we're really looking for the next, we're looking for a multi-hyphenate, you know, the next Phoebe Waller-Bridge, someone that can write and act, and as if it's like this innovative thing. And it hasn't been done before. But anyway, I'm very
the actual off. Part of the human condition as well.
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, my question is, what was it like working with someone who is, you know, the writer, director, and an actor, and you're obviously there on set as an actor? How did that differ to working on other acting jobs where the director is the director, the writer is the writer, and then, you know, the cast is the cast?
I mean, one of the things that sort of defines working with Gervais over sort of your more journeyman style director is that because he's so intensely involved at the top level of his production, he knows how to save time.
Right. That's interesting. So like,
Yeah, generally, like a working day on a shoot would be, you know, this is very much a generalization, but it would be, we start rolling cameras at 8 o'clock in the morning and like wrap camera at 7 o'clock in the evening. And obviously there's makeup before that, costume before that, everything like that, all the setup and then after.
Yeah.
But on a Gervais shoot, if you're still working at 4:30, something's gone wrong.
Really?
Yeah. Like, you know, he comes in knowing full well, right, I know what coverage I need.
Okay.
And that, there doesn't need to be a conversation about that. That, you know, he doesn't need to pass it by the director because he is the director. He doesn't need to pass it by the writer because he is the writer.
Right.
He doesn't need to pass it by his top star because guess what?
Yeah.
So, and he has an almost telepathic relationship with his director of photography.
Okay. Is that the same guy he's used on his various projects?
I think that he's been working with Hawke since Extras. So, basically everything sort of post office.
Interesting.
So they've got this telepathic relationship. Hawke, the director of photography, has a telepathic relationship with the B camera.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, there's not much talking, there's not much faffing around. And Ricky is the master of doing like cross camera shots.
Okay.
Because then he knows that in terms of sound in the edit, he doesn't have to faff around, like, you know, with multiple different framings. Like he's got the sound already synced.
Yeah.
So everything he does in like the pre-production is in service of getting everything done as quickly as possible.
Okay, that's great. And so how does that affect you as an actor? Obviously, it means you've got a shorter day, but does it also mean that you have less takes than you would have usually on another shoot?
Well, it's there's a weird paradox to it because you never feel rushed. And I think that's because, as well as Ricky's many other talents, one of his low-key talents that not a lot of people are talking about is how good he is as a casting director. And that sounds like I'm sort of blowing smoke up my own ass, but like he casts people because of what they represent and what they can do.
Yeah.
So if you're there, he knows, right, I can get this performance out of this actor. And by and large, what will happen is we get one go around where we'll do the script as written, and then the rest of it is playtime.
Yeah.
Because he's got the core of what he needs. And then the rest of it is, right, maybe we'll find something fun in the edit that we can do, that we can cut to quickly.
Okay.
Or one of the extensive blooper reels that we'll make for the for YouTube. But yeah, that's kind of how that works. Like, you know, it's, he brings on people that he knows can hang with everyone else in the cast in terms of sort of like comedy performance. But in addition to that, there doesn't need to be much quote unquote acting per se.
Yeah. Right.
Because like he casts people that are recognizable as what they are. Okay. Like, you know, the character of James in Afterlife isn't a million miles away from Joe in Bad Education. Like, yeah. I like to call it a kind of sort of bewildered innocence.
Yeah. Okay.
Which, you know, I've proven that I can do that. So there didn't need to be much work going into it. I just needed to bring what I can do.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It completely makes sense. And with this, you mentioned playtime, will that involve improv on certain scenes?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so, how like, are you with improv? Do you enjoy it?
I love improv. Yeah. It was a big part of my university career, sort of in the extracurricular stuff. So I've got a good grounding in improv, and I reckon I can hang. But I mean, by and large, like, you know, as sort of exuberant as the character of James is, like, you know, he exists in a world of extremely funny characters, heightened characters.
Yeah.
So more often than not in the improv scenes, I'll be playing the straight man to someone else's lunacy.
Yeah.
Which is tough when you're working with some of the funniest people working in the British comedy industry, because you're like, right, well, I can tell something magical is happening here.
Yeah.
And I mustn't ruin it by laughing.
Yeah, I know. It's tough, man. It's so tough not to corpse.
It's so hard. I mean, like, you know, working opposite David Earl as Brian Gittins.
He's so funny, that dude.
Like the stuff that you can spin out seemingly from nowhere.
Yeah, man.
Coming at 90 degrees to dialogue and the material, and you're like, I can't. What am I supposed to do? I've just got to sort of step back, just make sure I'm slightly out of frame, and the shoulders start going.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. I did his gong. You know, he's got this gonk show.
Yeah.
I did his gonk show and died on my ass. But he's like in character that, you know, he's the MC for that. and I was in character. But the way that my character was is sort of like is trying to play, be very deadpan. And he just completely just destroyed that, because it wasn't like I was going up having banter with him, because that wasn't within my character's realm.
Sure.
But it was just brilliant to watch him just, well, just destroy me, but just like, just on the moment, in the moment, just being so like loose, you know, and just coming up with shit at the top of his head.
He's a once in a generation performer, because like the character of Brian Gittings is so complete.
Yeah.
So fully formed that you can basically just slot him into any scenario and
you
know something's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like he's a volatile chemical element. He's the potassium in the water.
Yeah.
So like, you know, something's going to happen. It could be explosive. It could be tragic, but something will happen.
Yeah.
Much in the same way as sort of like early Johnny Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you know, he's a nuclear bomb of a comedy performer. It's incredible to watch, and a privilege to watch, I think.
Yeah, very much so. And do you find that have you developed a lot of friendships over the years from people you've met on set, or do you find it's very much a case of, right, you go on, you do your thing, and then, you know, at the end of the day, you wrap, and that's kind of it. You walk away and it's just work.
It's sort of a combination of the two, leaning more towards the second.
Really?
Okay. Because, like, it's hard sometimes to get attached to these things, and you try to avoid it where you can, because you know that on wrap it's over. Like, you know, this little sort of
family you've created almost, right?
That's it. Like, you know, you're sort of living in this weird little commune where you're in each other's pockets for like, you know, 14, 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
And so like by the end of it, you're obviously friends and you get along.
Yeah.
But there's a certain degree of separation between sort of where you were on set and where you were sort of in real life.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I think I felt this most keenly with Bad Education.
Really?
Because we did, like, you know, we did all three series and a film over the period of about 3 years.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of stuff to make in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I love all of them dearly. And if I wanted to get in contact with any of them, I know that I absolutely could, but I don't. And I'm not sure if anyone else does either. It could be that I'm left out of the WhatsApp. That's possible. But, you know, I suppose to a degree, like, you know, there's from the outside, and it's something that I've explored on some of the Q&As that I've done on TikTok.
Yeah.
Like, you know, sure, you create this thing together, but, you know, creating art is as much a job as it is a craft.
Yes.
And, you know, how close are you with your work colleagues generally? Like, you know, sure, we're off there making a TV show, but like in your office, do you like hang out with everyone there? Maybe not, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And having, you know, seen the likes of Ricky, who's, as you say, he's got this creative control, this authorship, does it motivate you to want to create and write your own ideas and shows? Because obviously you've done stand-up, so you have that within you, but are you interested in creating your own sitcom or something along those lines?
It sort of goes on and off the boil with this. Okay. Like, right. Sometimes I feel like that's absolutely what I should be doing.
Yeah.
But then the two twin dragons of imposter syndrome, number one, and number two, just the sheer difficulty of getting something from a Word document on your laptop to screen. Like, the journey is so daunting.
It's such a long process.
And like, you know, I find myself like, again, you know, it's not entirely that. It's also down to the fact that I look at it and I go, this probably isn't good enough. And it's, you know, it's a shame. And I'm sure, like, you know, if I was willing to just absolutely fully commit to it for however long it took, I could make something work. But I feel like maybe it will change as I, you know, get older. And like, you know, because I mean I'm 28 now, and like, you know, I've been professionally acting for 10 years, nearly 10 years in February. And I wonder if when it gets to 15 years, I'll be thinking to myself, I've done all I can in terms of like my acting career, and now I need to think about doing something else, and I'd want to stay in a creative field. So it may end up that I transition into writing, or maybe even transition back to stand-up and try and conquer that world. Again, it's impossible to say, but certainly where I am right now, I think to myself, acting's what you're good at. stay in your lane for now. Like, you know, keep those muscles sharp. Like, you know, I'm always writing. I'm always coming up with stuff and thinking about things in those terms, but less of sort of like, oh, this will definitely get made, and more of just don't let those muscles atrophy. But for now, focus on what you're known best for.
Yeah. It's a beautiful thing though, being in the comedy industry, that you have those options where you're like, you know what, if I want to go off and do stand up again, I can. If I want to try and write something, I can, because they're all interlinked as long as it's funny.
But one of the beauties of stand up, and like, you know, this isn't like a profound thought that I had, like, you know, a lot of comedians talk about this, but like the beauty of being able to do stand up comedy is that, you know, you've got a gig tonight and you're on the train coming in and you write something down when you're on the train. And then a few hours later, you'll say it in front of a group of people, and it will live or die based on whether it, you know, it could be funny, it could be not. But the higher wire act of being able to go, this is a thing that I literally wrote today and I've put it in action today.
Yeah.
There's something so beautiful about that. And like, you know, when it comes to creating longer form shows, obviously, you know, the work comes in there, but just, I just love the fact that I can have an idea and be able to express it in front of a room full of largely drunk locals in a pub basement in Kentish Town.
Yeah, top.
Excellent. But yeah.
So
yeah, I love it.
So, I mean, on that note, you know, had this idea of coming up with the idea and then just going on stage. In a way, I guess it's similar to TikTok, you know, where you can have something and you can just put it out there. What was your reasoning behind starting to do, you know, your videos and TikTok? Because as I said before, is that you're very open and honest and transparent, which I think is a really, really amazing thing. But also, like, it takes some bravery, doesn't it, to like push beyond? Because as you said, you could just be an actor and do your thing and post every time you've got a job and keep that sort of like kind of shiny quality to it. But instead, you do sort of open it up and you say if you're feeling down, and you answer questions from followers about, I don't know, certain things you're going through. What was the reason behind starting to do that?
I mean, it's always been part of my modus operandi on social media, especially sort of around 2015, 16, where I personally was going through a bit of a rough place.
Okay.
And like, it occurred to me sort of, especially around then, that like, when we spoke earlier, sort of like about the sort of mystification process of like, you know, the creative industry.
Yeah.
And especially around that time, and it sort of has continued since then, the whole sort of Be Kind movement and like, you know, being open with mental health.
Yeah.
You know, which is, I mean, people call it brave, and I guess to a certain degree it is, but it's not, I don't feel like I'm making a conscious decision to do something brave.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just more sort of like, this is something we should be talking about. Like, you know, we're not all okay, and like, you know, maybe, I mean, you know, I'm not saying I'm a super famous celebrity, but like, you know, someone working in like his dream job in a creative industry like can also still suffer and still like, you know, worry and have stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've tried to communicate to my followers since year dot. TikTok sort of ended up, I mean, this was never the plan with TikTok. Like, you know, I had the app and was sort of like flicking through videos and like, oh, this is fun. And like, you know, occasionally something would come up where it would be someone talking like, you know, with great honesty and great passion about themselves and how they're feeling. And I saw that, and I guess that was at the back of my mind. I mean, I started off just doing like these silly little skits while I was walking around my town in the dead of night. But then that, like, once it started to take off and people were sort of realizing, oh, Joe from Bad Education's on TikTok, and the numbers started to grow and like questions started to come in, I thought to myself, well, this is a near enough perfect way to talk about the actual realities and the ins and outs of working in the creative industry, where it's simply I can just pick a question from a list of questions and just talk directly down the down the lens for 15 seconds to a minute. And then that's it, that's the video, and then I can upload that and it can be in front of people, like from the germ of the idea to completion, like almost a mirror opposite of creating your own sitcom.
Yeah.
I can have an idea and it can be on TikTok within 5 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's quite a liberating thing. And do you find that satisfying, or I guess it could be both. Do you find it satisfying, I was going to say, or do you have elements of anxiety associated with putting these videos out and getting certain feedback from followers?
Honestly, it's okay. Like I said earlier, I don't consider it a particularly brave act.
Yeah.
For myself, at least. I know for others, being able to share that is a great burden and a great challenge. But for me, it's not something. I mean, I don't know if it means I'm oversharing or if I'm comfortable with oversharing. But like, you know, I've clearly drawn a line between sort of like my professional, my personal life on there. Like, you know, I don't talk about, you know, where I live or who I date or like, you know, anything like that. I've sectioned that off, but I'm more than happy to talk about the industry and the struggles within it. Especially because I get a lot of questions from people on there who like have ambitions to work in this field.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I'm not doing this to scare them away. I'm doing this to make them really, really think about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's easy when you're younger, and TikTok does skew younger. It's easy when you're younger to go, oh, I will just be an actor. Whereas, you know, the reality of it is, if you want to be an actor, get ready to starve. And if you want to be an actor, it's not just talent. You also have to have an enormous pool of luck. And then once the luck comes, you have to be ready to graft. Like, you know, it's not all premieres and PAs and sunshine and rainbows and like vast, vast buckets of cocaine. It's just not like that.
No.
And I think people should be made aware of that, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. It does sound a bit, now that I say it out loud, that I'm trying to scare them off, and I'm really not. Like, it's just a perspective thing to actually think about the realities of what working in the creative industry is, because it's not easy.
Yeah. I think it's a great thing that you're doing. I know you're saying, you know, you feel like it's a brave thing to do, but it's definitely a helpful thing to be doing for others. Have you gone in for castings, for instance, and have you noticed it having a ricochet in that respect in terms of, I don't know, casting directors or anyone else saying, oh, I really like what you're doing?
I mean, it's brought in a couple of opportunities, less so much in casting. Like, I've ended up doing a couple of radio interviews.
Okay.
Sort of based on the fact that, like, you know, I've been open about something or I've talked about something specific.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like big time. Like, you know, it's not anything like that. I mean, I don't know how TikTok will have affected casting so much, because I started making these videos in April of this year. And as at time of recording, we're not back into like actual casting rooms. Everything's still done remotely with self-tapes.
Yeah.
So it's, feedback is vanishingly small.
Right.
Although things are changing, which is good.
Yeah.
Well, the purported to change, which is good.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see. But like, you know, the sort of in-person aspect of casting is now gone. So it's difficult to see what sort of impact I'm having on the industry. Hark at me.
Yeah. But, how are you finding doing the castings remotely? Do you prefer them, or would you rather be in the room?
I don't like it.
No.
Like, I've always prided myself on being someone who's good in the room.
Yeah.
And I think it's how I've got, I think, the vast bulk of like some of my jobs. Like, you know, I have good relationships with casting directors who like sort of treat me as a secret weapon in a way.
Yeah.
Shout out to Tracy Gillam and Joan Ripley, who basically, like, you know, they'll be presented with a thing and they're like, well, we'll send Ethan in because something will happen. Right. Like, you know, he can change the game. He can shape things like that. And that wouldn't have happened if I was doing it with self-tapes. Like, I feel so desperately sorry for actors who are joining the industry within the last year and a half, because it never used to be this dehumanizing.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you know, we as performers now, like, you know, when we get an audition, we sit there, we learn our lines, we perform to a phone or a camera on a stick, potentially someone reading in, and then you make that and then you send it off into the void, and like half the time you don't even know if they've got it or not.
Yeah.
And it sort of feels like again, these sorts of things are changing. I think there was a lot of, especially early days when like everything was up in the air, it felt like there was very much a power imbalance between sort of like production and the actors auditioning for it. And okay. I think it's starting to be redressed now. Okay. But I mean, one of the advantages or benefits, I guess, is that because we've been forced into this position, we've also, as actors, had to become good camera technicians.
Yeah.
We've had to become good lighting technicians. If you work in voiceover, which I've done a smattering of, you become a good audio engineer.
Yeah.
And like, you know, these are good skills to have. And like, you know, I certainly, in terms of audio engineering especially, I wouldn't have ever sort of learn how to do it unless I was sort of required to make like reels for voiceover auditions.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that makes complete sense.
So it's all good skills. It's just, you know, it's troubling to me that, like, you know, as I say, that young actors are sort of coming into this industry and, like, you know, feeling like, I mean, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and even I sort of feel like I'm like screaming into the void sometimes with these auditions.
Yeah,
I can't imagine how dehumanizing it must feel for young actors who don't have that level of experience.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like balancing acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
On casting directors and that side of things, how proactive are you in terms of saying, hey, it's Ethan here, I'm still alive? Do you leave that all to your agent, or do you still try and build up a personal rapport with casting directors and even producers and that type of thing?
I near enough leave it to my agent for the most part. Right. I guess that the kind of split of the deal is that he's sort of on the industry side and I'm sort of on the kind of, this is such a wanky phrase, but on the personal branding side.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, you know, I run all my social media and, like, you know, I like to present who I am there. Whereas Michael's sort of in charge of presenting me as a, you know, the sword for hire comedy mercenary.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, sometimes those worlds overlap, like I mentioned with sort of like the radio stuff and, you know, things like that. Sometimes it does overlap and that's always fun. Mm-hmm. But yeah, by and large, like, you know, again, things are so different now because, like, you know, those relationships that I'd have with casting directors and producers would grow organically for auditioning for roles, getting them, and then working on them, especially with the producers. Like, you know, it would grow organically from that.
Yeah.
Difference again now is that there isn't that so much. Like, you know, I'm in a room with a phone on a stick.
Yeah.
Pretending to be whatever it is. I mean, it may come back. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure whether this would be one of those industries that sort of realizes we never really needed to hire out an office space.
Yeah. And just cutting down on overheads.
Yeah. Because I mean, you know, I imagine it must be fairly expensive to set up in the Union Church on Tottenham Court Road for 3 days.
Yeah, all the Pret-a-Mangers. Just think about all the cups of coffees a director has.
All of the avocado toasts.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know if it will come back. I do think that you lose something with self-tapes. I think that really is the case. I mean, Equity have come through recently with some sort of like proposed guidelines for self-taping.
Okay.
Because you'd get through things where you'd be like, you'd have maybe 36 hours to learn a 4-page script.
Right.
With multiple characters and then like be required to not only make that, but edit it and then get it out and everything like that. And like, you know, it's possible to do.
Yeah.
But like you lose quality on it, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the end of the day, like if you want them to be off book and you've given them 36 hours to learn 5 or 6 pages, that's not a test of acting acumen. That's a memory test.
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's not, that's not what you should be looking for, but you know, Equity are putting guidelines in place to allow for more time. And like, you know, hopefully things will sort of skew back to the norm, even if we're not directly in person.
Yeah. Yeah. Fingers crossed. So, Ethan, what do you do outside of work to relax and unwind? What's your leisure of choice?
Well, I'm a big old Dungeons and Dragons boy.
Okay.
This is something that I came into quite late in my life, and I've found it very much a solace.
Okay.
In times of trouble, I mean, I've always been a big video gamer, and still am to a certain degree. But there's something kind of beautiful about like a tabletop role-playing game, especially in the group that I have, like in locally I work with, or play with I should say, a voiceover artist, a musical theater teacher, and an IT technician with an interest in amateur musical theater.
Interesting. Did you know each other before you started playing?
Yeah, one of them is a friend from school, and okay. I met the other two through her.
Okay.
And like we've become a very close-knit group, and like
that's great.
Every week we, you know, we get together and we tell a collaborative story together.
Okay.
With sort of using dice as the cue.
Right.
And it's as a creative outlet, like outside of sort of like acting, because like, you know, they say never make your hobby your job. But like, you know, I love creative things. I love doing creative things.
Yeah.
And like, you know, even outside of it being my job, I also like to do it in my spare time.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, writing these grand campaigns and playing these, you know, incredible characters and everything like that. It's a joy to experience, and also sort of keeps my, I mean, it's almost like keeping my acting muscles fresh as well. Cause like, you know, we get into it on the role play side, which is because we might as well, we're all performers, we're all storytellers. So
it makes sense.
It makes it more fun. It makes it, you know, more engaging and immersive.
Yeah. 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 But I guess also the beauty of it is, yeah, you are sort of flexing those muscles, but at the same time, you're not doing it for any specific outcome, you know, any sort of like, well, if I do this, then I could get this job, or it's just purely for the play of it, for the pleasure.
It's pure fun.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what happens in these games will be essentially just between the four of us.
Yeah.
And like, you know, those moments that we create together will just be for us, and like, it's not going to go anywhere. And that's kind of freeing in a way.
Yeah, that is until you decide to create a dedicated TikTok channel for your Dungeons and Dragons games.
No one will watch it.
You'd be surprised. I bet you it'll go viral.
Well, maybe
it's always
then.
The niche thing. Like, think about all the subreddits. You know, like some of these niche subreddits. Are you a Reddit fan?
I've dappled. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how many different niche subjects there are, and you've got thousands upon thousands of people interacting with each other on them.
I mean, it's much the same as you say on TikTok. Like, you know, I God knows what the algorithm was feeding me that day, but I accidentally ended up on wood carving TikTok. And like, you know, just spent a good 10 minutes just watching people carve these beautiful sculptures
right
out of logs. And I'm looking at that, and like, you know, this, some of these videos had like millions of views.
I've talked to a few friends about, have you heard of Pool Guy?
Yes.
Oh my God. His videos are amazing.
Incredible. Who could have foreseen it?
Okay. For anyone listening that doesn't know who Pool Guy is, he's a professional pool cleaner, and he does TikTok videos, which are sort of these incredible, slickly edited montages of him like doing before and afters of these pools. And as a result, he's got over, I think, 6 million followers. And now he like cleans all these celebs' pools. He's like, so today I'm Rio Ferdinand. And then the thing I love about him is at the end, he does this thing. It's like, that's it. Holler at your boy for the pool work.
Love it.
Pool boy out.
There's another guy, his name escapes me right now, but he's an Australian like phone repairman.
Okay.
And like, he's again, very slickly edited, where like, you know, you'd be sent through like an iPhone 6 that's been water damaged.
Yeah.
And he opens up the back and he's narrating it with this really, really high energy Australian narration. And like at the end of it, like, you know, he'll take the thing out and replace it, put it back together. The screen will come on and then it'll just cut back to him going, "All in a day's work, mate." Perfect. What a catchphrase.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that he is just selling merch through the roof with that catchphrase and T-shirt.
I mean, it's improved his business no end, because like it's people incredible. Who have phone problems are like, I'll pay a little extra to ship it to this guy.
Totally, yeah. I mean, it's smart. It's really smart. Yeah, it's opened up.
I must
up.
Get his name, because it would be a shame to.
I'm definitely going to
talk about him and not credit him.
Yeah, I'm going to be trawling through his TikTok this evening for sure.
I will find it, but yeah. Keep going. I will find it.
But it's, yeah, I mean, it's almost like a reincarnation of what happened initially with the internet, and like opening up all these different corridors of interests, and you can sort of double down on that on TikTok, and
it sort
just come
feels
across
like,
all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like early YouTube.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah.
When like no one had any idea what was going to end up being popular, and like, you know, sort of the level of what it could be done. For the record, the guy is called Max Hawker.
Max Hawker, okay.
264,000 followers. He repairs phones.
We're about to go up to a million after this podcast.
I'll tell you.
I wish.
But yeah, I mean, it feels like the internet. I mean, now that we've been with the internet for as long as we have now, it does feel like it travels in sort of a kind of cyclical nature. Like, you know, a new thing will come up and that will be the king shit for a while.
Yeah, because for me, TikTok almost feels like a reincarnation of Vine, but with people doing dance moves.
Absolutely. Like, you know, it's Chinese Vine.
That's what it is. Yeah, it's Chinese Vine.
But like, you know, there's in a world where, like, you know, even news sites are like, or like comedy article websites are obsessed with pivoting to video.
Yeah.
Like, they can't keep up, I don't think, with like free video making software like TikTok, where, like, you know, a wood carver or a phone repair guy or a pool cleaner can become to the level of like an actual, like, you know, B or C list celebrity in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And like, you know, what are you supposed to do as like a newspaper to go, right, well, we got to get on that? It just doesn't work. Like, the internet's kind of changed everything.
Really has. I mean, I know on Snap, formerly known as Snapchat, they have...
Has it officially changed its name?
Yeah, they just took out the chat. They thought it was
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's people are just lazy. They don't want to double up on the words. So let's just call it Snap.
Well, it is a... Snappier. Yeah.
That's what they pay in the big bucks for, guys.
Yeah, the comedy muscle's never atrophied. I haven't been on stage in 3 years, but it doesn't matter. I haven't missed a day.
But they've got like this whole thing where brands, I don't know, it's like I don't fully understand it, if I'm honest with you, but brands have their own channels on there and they create all these different brand contents, and this whole big separate entity where, you know, they use it as an advertising opportunity. And I'm sure they do it on TikTok as well.
But, oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think Instagram did this first, because, like, you know, if you're a brand, like, being able to produce just like for Instagram, like a slickly made picture or a video is a great way to just up the level of branding, because, like, you can just plaster it everywhere and like people will share it.
Yeah.
You know, with, in a way, especially with some elements of branding, which I don't particularly like, but in to a certain degree, we've essentially become advertisers to ourselves and each other.
Yes.
Because, like, we'll share branded content because it is slickly produced and looks good. I mean, Twitter's a bastard for this. Every single time I see the social media team of a brand have a fun little play back and forth with another brand, it makes me feel physically sick.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm looking at it and I'm like, sorry, KFC and Burger King aren't friends.
Yeah.
And corporations aren't people. But can we stop pretending that this is all sort of like, oh, well, my chicken wing's better than your Whopper. Oh, yeah. I think not good. Stop it. Enough. It's not funny and it's not cute.
Yeah. But they get loads of coverage off the back of it.
Yeah, because like people retweet it like, lol, KFC won this one.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, we're lambs marching to our own slaughter in a lot of ways.
It's a good way of putting it.
Because... I don't know. There's something I think uniquely sick about internet branding for certain companies. I don't know. That's one of my high horse issues that I wasn't expecting to articulate on this podcast, if I'm honest with you.
No, but I was. It's interesting you said that. I was reading an article the other day about how a load of brands jumped on all kinds of social issues, from the Me Too movement to Black Lives Matter.
And
so that's the term is wokenomics.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, where they're not necessarily doing it because they believe it to be the right thing to do, or because they necessarily inherently believe in these philosophies or ideals, but because it's going to increase the value of their brand by making them more trustworthy.
Certainly the first time that I recognized it was around Pride Month.
Right.
And I've seen a number of deep dives, because every single year a big corporation will change their Twitter logo to have a rainbow in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But every big corporation has Twitter outlets in different countries. Right.
Mm.
And you can type in whatever the name of that brand is, and all their different, you know, country specific ones will come up, and you can see exactly which ones they don't put the rainbow flag on, because they don't want to upset, say, for example, just to pluck a name out of the air, Russia.
Yeah.
So the logo is still the same on that. And it's so like the disguise is so thin, like it's tissue thin. Like, and then, you know, that's before you even get into like, you know, especially larger brands like your Coca-Cola's or your Nestle's who have vested interests in, especially extremely toxic right-wing politics. And, you know, you change your logo on your thing. Great. It's a rainbow. What are you actually doing though?
Yeah. But then the same could be said of celebrities as well, you know, during these periods as well. You know, it's and I mean, the same could be said of anyone really, isn't it? They'll post something in support of something, but then what action are we actually taking as a result?
And that's not to tar everyone with the same brush, because there are a number of celebs who are more than happy to put their money where their mouth is and their feet on the ground. But certainly you're absolutely right. There are, I mean, virtue signaling is the term, isn't it? It's not a term that I particularly enjoy, because I feel it's been co-opted by the sort of people who use it in a way which it was not intended. But certainly the basic fundamental principle of just saying that you support something while having no intention of actually helping, that's a great definition of virtue signaling, really. And it's across brands, it's across corporations, but then even then it comes down to normal people. Like, you know, I see it every time, like, you know, when God, this is getting dark, but like when George Floyd was murdered, the amount of people on my Instagram who put up a black square, and it was like, okay, great, you helped by doing that, did you? Because I know for a fact none of them contributed any money.
I think sometimes that's in part to do with societal pressure, where they feel like if they don't do it, they're going to be labeled, right, as being
sort of like the
anti-
whole poppy thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know how
exactly it.
Certain interest groups will throw an absolute bitch fit if someone turns up on any day between the 1st of September and the 11th of November not wearing a poppy.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, that kind of, societal pressure, that goes, traces all the way back. There's always been something on those lines. But I do think definitely social media, what we've been talking about, increases that pressure and almost, you know, you're riddled with anxiety in terms of, well, which way do I go? How do I navigate through this?
I've broken through the matrix to a certain extent, because just maybe a year or so ago, early days of the pandemic, when everyone was losing their minds on social media and Gal Gadot did a version of Imagine with all her celebrity friends and Madonna did something stupid in a bath and, like, you know, all that was happening.
Yeah.
And I'd suddenly, the scales fell from my eyes and I was like, the internet isn't real. Like, this is all nonsense. Nothing that happens on the internet actually matters. None of it.
Interesting.
And like, it's certainly something that I have a reasonable, you know, to make it about me again, I have a reasonable following on social media, you know, not great, but, you know, reasonable. In reality, no one knows who I am. Like, you know, in the real world, I'm a non-entity. And looking at those numbers, like, you know, I've got in between April and now on TikTok, I've managed to increase it to nearly 70,000 followers, or you could say 69,000 followers, which is, you know, nice.
Yeah.
But that hasn't had any real world impacts. Like, the internet isn't real. And like,
did that have an impact in terms of you feeling more liberated to then go out and create the content you've been creating on TikTok as a result of knowing that?
Absolutely. And like, it's
because you feel like you don't give a, you're like, you know what? Fuck it. If people judge me, they judge me. It doesn't matter because it isn't real. It's almost like part of the Matrix.
It really did. And like, the other thing that it did was made me realize how brain damaged terminally online people are.
Okay.
And I don't use the term brain damage lightly.
Yeah.
Like, I think there are folks, especially on Twitter, which is an absolute cesspool of a website.
Yeah.
But like, there are people there who define their entire lives around likes and retweets.
Mm.
And it's not healthy. Like, you can see these people, like, you know, both on right and left, saying increasingly outrageous things, chasing clicks, and none of it matters. None of it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you that's not going to be in your obituary.
Yeah.
You know, he once put up a funny thing where he dunked on Lawrence Fox. It got 5,000 retweets. Rest in peace. Like, and like, it's especially in an age now where you know, we used to kind of sort of loosely use the term rent-a-gob to, you know, describe someone who would pretend to have opinions for money.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like a massive industry now.
Huge industry.
I mean, especially around COVID. I mean, this was really the time when it sort of went into overdrive, because you've got all sorts of different versions of people pretending to have opinions for money. Like, you know, you've got your COVID isn't real folks. You've got your anti-lockdown folks. You've got your anti-masks. You've got your anti-vaxxers, or a combination of all of them. And especially people who are prominent, like you know, had come from money, like, you know, your Lawrence Foxes or your Right Said Freds or your Julia Hartley Brewers. I don't believe for a second that they actually believe those things.
Yeah.
It's but, you know, they can
be bought. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. They are able to just detach from what their ideals and beliefs are to fast track their careers as a result.
But I think it's kind of an evil dimension of the realization that I had.
It doesn't matter.
None of it matters. It's just like, you know, it will generate outrage for 24 hours. You get to be the main character of Twitter for a day.
But then it does have impacts in the real world when you have, you know, we talk about cancel culture and people say certain things on Twitter, and maybe it's for the same reasons we just discussed. Maybe they're doing it because they want to cause outrage. And then as a result, they lose career opportunities in the real world.
It does bleed over, and I think we're starting to see that more and more now. Like, I think, because I mean, if you think about it, Lawrence Fox's trajectory down the rabbit hole really started like at the beginning of this year, if you can believe that, because that was around the time of the Question Time interview, right?
Yeah,
and like, you know,
seems like a lifetime ago, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah, Bean Dad was this year. Yeah. But so that happened, what, in January, February, wherever it was. And like, you know, at the time, no disrespect to the man, like, you know, Lawrence Fox's career wasn't going great. Like, we hadn't seen him on TV for a while. His album wasn't selling. So like, he says a thing and it garners some interest. And now he's on the news and people are talking about him. And like, yeah, you know, he's tapped into a kind of well of frustration amongst people who are feeling a certain way.
Mm.
And he taps into that and it starts to go and go and go and go and go. But he's known for this now.
Mm.
Like, you know, he has made a kind of lateral move from being an actor from a dynasty of actors to being a kind of provocateur. And we see it time and again where provocateurs have a shelf life because you just have to keep getting more mad. Like, you know, it feels like there's no upper limit, but of course there is an upper limit, because eventually you're going to cross a line.
Yeah.
And it's a line you have to constantly be pushing towards, because if you're not, then you're not garnering the outrage clicks that your paymasters are paying you for.
Piers Morgan is a master at that.
He's the king of it.
Hmm.
He's the absolute king of it. I mean, like, you know, it's, but again, in the real world, it did end up backfiring.
Yeah.
Because, you know, while, you know, I'm a champion of free speech to an extent, but like, you know, there are limits.
Mm.
And I think that, I mean, one of the biggest problems that we have with free speech, I think, is the either people pretend not to know or genuinely don't know the distinction between what free speech actually means in a political sense and free speech sort of generally.
Mm.
Like, you know, for all the talk of cancel culture, having your Twitter account deactivated isn't a free speech issue.
Mm.
You know, that's a corporation deciding that they don't want that content on their platform, in the same way that you have to wear a shirt when you go into a supermarket.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not really a decision that they decide, is it? It's usually pressurized into that decision because they want the interactions, they want the clicks, it increases the value of their company. But yeah, I understand what you're saying.
I mean, then there's a further conversation to have about how that ties into advertisers and everything like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But then you have to then talk about the fact that this isn't a new problem.
No.
Like, you know, this has existed since advertising existed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even going back to, like, you talk about Hollywood, like, even going back to, like, the Hays Code, like, in the 40s, which, like, you know, crippled certain actors' career because, like, their careers were built on sort of a kind of live sexuality and innuendo that suddenly wasn't allowed anymore.
Yeah.
Like, none of this is new. Like, you know, it's... and I think, I don't know, maybe the internet supercharged it to a certain degree, but I just simply feel these days that, like, people are happy to sort of be outraged about this sort of stuff when it suits them.
Yeah.
and act like it's a new thing when it has ever been thus. It's just you only care about it now.
Yeah, and also there is somewhere to amplify people's voices. So they can be heard now, which wasn't the case in the past. Not in the same direct manner.
No. I mean, you know, in that way, social media has been a blessing and a curse.
Mm.
Because before, a lot of stuff would be happening, like in the upper levels of corporations and advertising, things would be happening in a vacuum.
Yeah.
But it's not so much that anymore.
Yeah.
But then you have, you know, bad actors who will, and I'm not talking about Lawrence Fox when I say bad actors, lol. But like, you know, people with bad intentions who are happy to willfully misinterpret the reality of things around them to make a point or get some clicks. Yeah. Like the whole Dr. Seuss thing, if you remember that from a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Where they're like, oh, they're cancelling Dr. Seuss. And it's like, no, the company that prints Dr. Seuss have discontinued some books that weren't selling. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But of course, that was then a court celebre of free speech advocates saying, oh, they're banning Dr. Seuss because he's racist. And it's like, no.
Yeah.
Just these were books that no one has because like Green Eggs and Ham is the big seller.
Yeah.
And as it should be, because it's a good book.
Yeah. It's a great book. But that idea of going back to this idea of people creating outrage to, you know, for clickbait almost. The thing before social media, and I mean, they kind of arose together. But if you think back the creation of reality TV, and then particularly the Kardashians, who were able just to create a whole lifestyle and a whole brand just by presenting a certain version of themselves, which then stemmed a whole sort of beauty industry. And you know, we've got now, you know, young girls and I know some guys as well have aspirations to just have lip filler, etc. Because of the amount of influence that they had, they were showing a version of themselves. They're very smart in what they were doing. It was all calculated and it was all branding. It's that, but amplified and much more direct now.
I think when history looks back on this time, the fact that influencer became a job will be like the lead in the Roman water pipes.
Yeah.
Of our civilization. Like, you know, not to say that, like, you know, people shouldn't be allowed to make a job of like moving trends, because again, it is just basically advertising, but under a different guise, I guess. But I think you're absolutely right that with the rise of reality TV sort of in the early noughties and through to now, like, sure, like it became a case where, this is going to sound so mean, and I don't mean it to sound this way, but there's no other way to phrase it. Suddenly, you matter.
Yeah.
What you think and what you reckon matters now.
Yeah.
And sorry, sometimes what you think doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I hate to be so blunt about it, but most of us, in fact, nearly all of us, aren't that important or interesting. Not really.
Yeah.
He says on a podcast with his friend Steve, who makes a podcast.
I think he's been talking for an hour and five minutes
about himself.
At least you have the self-awareness to realize it.
I've seen the scales. They're falling from my eyes. The internet isn't real. Everyone, throw your phones into the sea.
Let's go back to the Stone Ages.
But don't throw your phone into the sea, because obviously follow me on TikTok, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
I make great content.
So you're clearly well-read. And so that leads me on. It's a nice segue to my next question. Are there any books that have had a positive impact or inspired you in some shape or form over the years? Doesn't have to be career related necessarily.
I would say of late, like recently, a kind of a 1-2 punch would be James O'Brien's two books, How to Be Right in a World Gone Wrong,
okay,
and How to Be Wrong, the follow-up.
Okay.
Where again, it was, I imagine it was a contributing factor to the scales falling from my eyes to a certain degree.
Mm.
Because actually being able to step back and analyze deeply held opinions and like look at who you are and why you are is I found particularly interesting. I'd recommend both books as sort of like a twofer. On the one side, looking at sort of like how you can, you know, essentially argue your own point and like, you know, be good in debate, where on the other side actually criticizing yourself and like looking at why you believe that and things. You know, because For the longest time, I was like, yeah, well, you know, I'm a creature of the left, you know, center left with socialist sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was instructive, I think, to look at someone analyzing themselves and then think about, well, why do you think that?
Yeah.
And I think that's a healthy thing that we all can do, especially as, like, you know, I mean, we've talked a lot about social media, but certainly I think it will help. It certainly helped me realize how damaging my engagement with social media can be.
Right.
Both to myself and to others.
Yeah. But you seem to have turned that on its head and you're using it in a positive sense.
Yeah.
In terms of the content that you're releasing.
For sure. And, like, you know, I think there is, you know, for all the talk of how awful social media is, there is good there.
Mm.
And, like, you know, it should be championed and fought for. But that doesn't happen until we really, really analyze ourselves and take a look at why we do the things that we do, why we believe the things that we believe, and why we feel it necessary to spread those things around.
Yeah.
I think a lot of things could be solved. A lot of problems that we're facing now could be solved if people had the ability to actually think about why they are, how they are.
Mm.
I think there's a real lack of introspection across all stripes of, you know, Twitter trolls to the highest echelons of government.
Yeah.
We've lost the ability, I think, to self-reflect.
Yeah. And, you know, it's like that cliche when it comes to the likes of trolls or whoever it is that just wants to fire out anger into the world. It's obviously they're not dealing with their own emotions a lot of the time. And as a result of that, you know, they build up a sense of anger and resentment at others and just fire that out because it makes them feel better about themselves in the moment.
I mean, I get very, very rarely I get negative comments on TikTok. It's actually quite a nice community that we've fostered there.
Yeah.
But when it does happen, instead of blowing up like I would have done maybe 2 or 3 years ago,
yeah,
my reaction is just simply to go, "And why did you say that?
Right.
What did you mean by that?"
Do you get any replies?
More often than not, after a couple of comments, I get an apology.
Ah, interesting.
Because I think, yeah, like, when if you force someone to go, "Yeah, I said that and that was out of order."
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, people are more than happy to actually, you know, reflect on their own actions and take responsibility for them.
Yeah.
But I think with the distance of the internet, like, you know, being able to post something and not actually have to physically say it to someone's, yes, face, like,
yeah.
But, like, when, even over the internet, if you challenge someone on it, 9 times out of 10, they'll be like, "Do you know what? You're right. That was out of order."
Yeah.
And the 1 out of 10 who don't do that, well, that's what the block button's for.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Vanquish the keyboard warriors.
That's it. Have them scream in the dark, as we all are.
Final question for you. What does the idea of balance mean to you or not, Ethan Lawrence?
The idea of balance, a very interesting question. I think in terms of my career a lot of times, and I think for balance for me is represented largely by security. You know, I like being in a situation where I don't have to worry. I feel equilibrium when I'm not stressed. And I know that almost seems like a trite answer in a way, but I do genuinely mean it. Like, balance comes from having your needs fulfilled. And I'm very lucky in that regard. Like, you know, I work in an industry that I've always wanted to work in. It's my dream job. And, like, for all the problems that it has, I wouldn't change it. Well, I would change some things, but I wouldn't change the actual working part of it for the world. And, like, yeah, you know, when the going's good and I don't have to worry about it, it's well paid enough that I don't have to, like, be panicking. And when it's bad, obviously there are backups. I can always go back to pizza delivery. I had a right laugh doing that. But in terms of balance, yeah, balance is equilibrium, and equilibrium is being in a position where you're not stressed and not having to worry, I think.
Great. Brilliant. All right, man. Been really, really great chatting with you.
And you. It'd be great to see you again.
Yeah, yeah. We'll have to do IRL for sure. I'd love to just go for a drink or go to a gig.
Well, that'd be nice. Nice.
That'd be a nice, gig. Isn't it? Yeah, an old gig. Gigaroonie. ironically, obviously, we've been talking about social media, and I'm going to ask you where is best to follow you on the internet.
Well, my social media is all unified under one name, which is at Ethan D. Lawrence. That's on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Also, if you want to buy a personalized bespoke video off me, you can go to my Cameo, where I'll do a video for your mum for her birthday if you want. And it's relatively cheap. I'm treating it like a tip jar, essentially. if you've liked my work and want a video, slap some money in the piggy bank and I'll do you a nice video.
Yeah, fine. All right. Look, Ethan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been great chatting with you.
It's been great chatting to you. Thank you so much for having me. Perfect.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.